This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and we're here with you. We begin by asking, is school safe? Now, it's a question we ask in the aftermath of deadly school shootings. It's a question we ask throughout much of 2020 as schools, teachers, and caregivers try to teach while battling a global pandemic of a deadly disease for which we had no cure and no vaccine. But last year brought hope for so many as safe, effective, free vaccines became available. First for the teachers, then for the middle and high schools, and finally, last year, for the youngest elementary school kids. Now, most of us thought we were going to be entering 2022 with students in seats and teachers in classrooms. But when the highly contagious Omicron variant exploded into American towns and cities, sending infection rates to record heights, it changed everything. And here's what some of you told us about the disruption you're living with at this moment.
Marissa, Staten Island, New York. It is a hot mess. Our school district is open. The new New York City mayor is adamantly opposed to shutting it down. And my kid's been in school 4 days and already has his third exposure since school started.
Hi, this is Kira from St. John's, Florida. Yes, our school is in person, and there are no safety protocols for COVID right now. Masks are completely optional. There's no vaccine requirements. There's no social distancing as our schools are too overcrowded.
My children go to Byron, Minnesota schools. They are not mandated to wear masks. It's hard to ask your children to wear masks when other kids aren't expected to wear masks.
Hi there, this is Bonnie, Parker, Colorado. And unfortunately, the school district I am a teacher in has pretty much no protections for us from COVID. Masking is not required. As long as students test negative, even if they've been directly exposed, they are allowed to come into school.
Hi, this is Lisa from St. Louis. I'm a sixth grade teacher in a large school district in St. Louis, and we are 20% of our teachers at least are out right now. Bus drivers all called out today. I foresee some virtual action in our future.
We're always so grateful to those of you who call in and share with us your stories at 877-869-8253. That is the way to do it. Now, clearly, school disruptions are occurring across the country. But in Chicago, the situation became particularly troubling last week. After 2 days of in-person learning, the Chicago Teachers Union voted last Tuesday to pivot to remote learning. And to the frustration of many parents, that decision wasn't announced until about 11 o'clock at night on Tuesday. And because the Chicago school district leaders want classes to remain in person this year, school was canceled altogether Wednesday through Friday of last week. And that left many parents in a bind.
This week has been extremely frustrating.
Our producer spoke with Vanessa Chavez, who has three children in Chicago Public Schools.
Having multiple kids at home when, you know, they've lived through this once before and, you know, want to be back in school. My kids are all vaccinated. You know, we follow all mitigation standards, even outside of school. And so, you know, we're frustrated. We're very, very frustrated.
Vanessa said her frustration goes all the way back to the Chicago Teachers Union strike in 2019.
I started looking at it and listening to all of the facts and all of the different viewpoints and, you know, trying to look at all sides of a story. You know, I've slowly over the years have become more and more angry towards the Chicago Teachers Union, whether it's political posturing or just wanting to pick a fight at all times. It's really frustrating to know that, you know, our kids and a whole generation of children are being, you know, held hostage and being held back.
And she doesn't think the school district is doing enough.
I think this is something that has been going on over the years. And had they probably stood a little firmer in the past, maybe we wouldn't be at the point that we are now. I feel that the Chicago Teachers Union is essentially a bully to CPS, to CPS families, even to their own members. And, you know, when you don't put a stop to the bullying, it just gets worse and worse and worse until somebody actually stands up to them. And I feel like a lot of the parents in the Chicago area are now starting to realize that they're going to be the ones that are going to have to be the adult in this whole relationship and actually stand up to the bully.
Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot has positioned herself in clear opposition to the teachers union decision to move to virtual learning. On Saturday afternoon, Mayor Lightfoot tweeted at the Chicago Teacher Union local, writing, "You're not listening. the best, safest place for kids to be is in school. Students need to be back in person as soon as possible, and that's what parents want. That's what the science supports. We will not relent. But the teachers' union describes the mayor's position as
dangerous. It is incompetent. It is unconscionable. I don't know how you recover from knowing that your boss refused to implement mitigations that were offered to her by the governor. How do you reconcile something like that?
That's Stacey Davis Gates, vice president of the Chicago Teachers Union, who spoke with The Takeaway on Friday. Gates was referring to a story that reporter Rich Miller broke last week, indicating that the Illinois governor had offered the city of Chicago additional tests and masks to help the school system, but that so far the city, which would actually have to pay for it, has not accepted. Asked to respond to parents like Vanessa Chavez, who view the union as a bully, Gates told The Takeaway she has some issues with how conversations about public schools often talk about parents and union members as though they're two entirely separate entities.
I have a seventh grader, I have a fifth grader, and I have a second grader. Parents do not have the market cornered on love and care for their children. In fact, the only reason why I sent my children back to school in August is because I trusted that the school community would keep them safe.
Here's how one teacher told us he feels about the current messy situation.
Hey, this is Nick in Chicago. I'm a CPS teacher. The feeling that I get is it's like I'm in the car and the parents are in the front seat arguing and fighting over where to go to dinner until finally someone blows up and loses their temper. And now we're not going anywhere and we're just driving in silence.
Nader Issa is a reporter covering education for the Chicago Sun-Times. Welcome to The Takeaway, Nader.
Thanks for having me.
Has there been progress over the course of the weekend in terms of discussions between the school district and the teachers union?
Yeah, so they negotiated late into Sunday night. The mayor even held off on canceling classes for Monday in case there was enough progress in negotiations. The teachers union held a meeting with its 25,000 members, but its union leaders didn't actually go to the meeting because they were still at the negotiating table. And so all signs point to progress being made. It's always a good sign when they're negotiating into the night. But obviously there wasn't enough progress because schools were canceled again on Monday for the fourth consecutive school day.
What are the big sticking points at this moment?
One is testing, and two is sort of this temporary return to remote learning for a few days. On testing, the teachers union had wanted every single student and staff member tested before they returned from winter break. They've since dropped that demand. They dropped it in their latest proposal made on Saturday. The remaining testing demand is for a switch to an opt-out program rather than opt-in. And what that is, a lot of districts around the country, around Illinois, in the suburbs of Chicago have used this. Basically, students would be defaulted into the testing program. Students are automatically enrolled, their parents are notified, and they can opt out if they want to. The way that the district has been doing it all school year is opt-in, where no students are defaulted into testing and parents have to go in, fill out a form, give their affirmative consent and register their students for testing. That at Chicago Public Schools and other districts has led to way lower participation rates among students. The district started out the school year with only about 3% of students registered. It's now up closer to 20%, but nowhere near the number that the teachers want to be tested weekly, or at least semi-regularly.
That is actually the central insight of behavioral economics. You know, we know this from the book Nudge, right? That if you want mass participation, you actually have to kind of drop those barriers. And often sort of that opt-in process is, even if it's a small barrier, it's nonetheless a barrier. I just want to be sure that I'm clear about one thing. Who is it that's being tested here? Are these students who are returning after being observed for potentially being exposed? Or is this sort of just a regular process of testing over the course of the semester, whether they're asymptomatic or not?
Yeah, so there's two types of testing. One is if you're feeling sick, if you think you have COVID, you were exposed, you go get tested. That's sort of the test that all of us think about when we think of COVID testing. This other form of testing that we're talking about is called screening testing. It's asymptomatic testing. Everyone who signs up just gets tested regularly. And it's sort of just to detect asymptomatic spread in the school district before people start feeling sick. Maybe they start shedding virus. You test positive and you can get those people isolated so that they're not spreading to classmates or to teachers or whoever it may be.
Now, I'm wondering, before this moment, what the relationship with the mayor has been like with the teachers union, particularly across the past year and a half of COVID and the great pivot and all of that. Sort of, is this a relationship built basically on trust and mutual respect, or has it been more tense?
I would not say there has been trust or mutual respect in this relationship. And it's really dated back, you can say, a decade. In the past 27 months, this is a third labor dispute. The teachers went on strike in 2019, and that was pre-pandemic, right before the pandemic. It was the fall of 2019, and that was more about pay and benefits were certainly on the table, but it was also about the teachers wanting more nurses in schools, more social workers, lower class sizes, sort of the bread and butter education issues. Then when the pandemic started, obviously there was remote learning. Mayor Lori Lightfoot wanted to get kids back into classrooms and during the 2020-2021 school year. And so January 2021, this time last year, there was a big dispute around reopening negotiations. The mayor tried to reopen schools. The teachers voted, said, no, we're teaching remotely. She locked them out. It was a very similar situation to what's happening right now. And then of course, right now, Chicago doesn't have any type of classes, remote or in person. And back in 2012, the teachers went on their first strike in 25 years here in Chicago under Mayor Rahm Emanuel. And the situation just hasn't improved. At the time, the teachers union started negotiating common good bargaining. And so they started negotiating about these sort of wraparound issues, these support issues that affect students, affect working conditions, that have nothing to do with pay and benefits. This year and last year, it's about health and safety.
In a recent volley in this struggle, Chicago Tribune reporter Gregory Pratt tweeted on Sunday morning, quote, another small note from City Hall. As Mayor Lightfoot remains in a dispute with the CTU over CPS remote learning and reopening, her chief of staff quietly extended work from home for the mayor's office staff for at least another week. And Nader, I want to come to this point about the mayor's staff, you know, working remotely. You know, I'm a teacher during the parts of the day when I'm not on the radio. I'm a college professor. And I remember at the start of all of this, we were told, be ready to pivot at any moment, right? Not just in the next few weeks, but for the next several years. So I guess my big question is, why weren't the Chicago Public Schools ready to pivot if necessary? I don't think teachers are saying at this point they want to cancel the semester. They're talking about sort of waiting out the surge. Why isn't there kind of a process in place for exactly what we expected to happen with a, you know, with this pandemic?
I think that's the big question. And the answer sort of lies in this ideological argument that the mayor has been making. If you listen to any of her press conferences over the past week, really any press conferences over the past year, Mayor Lightfoot has been just adamantly opposed to remote learning. She says it's been a bad thing for students who are economically disadvantaged, who are Black and brown, all of which are the majority of Chicago public school students. She says mental health has hurt, academic achievement and gaps have widened. And so it's an ideological argument. But if you listen to the teachers, right, nobody's saying, hey, let's be out for 2 months or 3 months. They've set a date. They want to go back January 18th. Next Tuesday after the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, just to ride out the surge. And for some context, you mentioned the Omicron wave. Chicago right now is in the middle of a record wave. There's the most number of cases, hospitalizations, positivity rate. Every metric is at or near a record high. And so it's really about riding out this wave, getting people tested, so that they're not spreading COVID, or at least exposing others to COVID in schools. And the response has been, well, remote learning is bad. And you ask any teacher, I mean, I'm in touch with teachers, even principals. Nobody wants to do remote learning. Nobody thinks it was fun. Nobody prefers to be in remote learning, but it's about being home and apart from each other while there's a surge. Just yesterday, the Chicago Public Health Commissioner, Dr. Allison, already, she was on a town hall that was sort of put together at the last minute with some parents. And she said, if this was pre-vaccine days, Chicago schools would be remote right now. She thinks the vaccine, the fact that the vaccine exists and is this other layer of protection, makes it okay for schools to be open. I think one issue with that argument is that there was a report in Chalkbeat a couple of days ago. They secured through a public record search vaccine rates per school. And there are some schools with just very, very, very low vaccine rates. And overall, younger students at Chicago Public Schools are about a fifth vaccinated. Older students, 12 to 17, are about 60% vaccinated. And so the vaccine does help. It's another layer, if you've seen that sort of Swiss cheese model of each layer sort of protecting from the virus and building on each other. It's another one of those Swiss cheese slices. But it's the public health expert is saying it's enough. It's I don't know, the anxiety among parents and students and staff is enough right now that it's leading to what we're seeing now.
You know, your point about this being ideological is an interesting one. I mean, on the one hand, the mayor is not being exclusively ideological. We did see important learning loss, mental health questions as a result of the extended process of virtual learning. But when you point to the low vaccination rates among young people in the schools, I suppose I'm wondering, is that driven by sort of ideological and partisan concerns, or is it your sense that this is an access problem? I have to say, those are really quite low numbers, particularly for the youngest students.
I don't think it's about politics in Chicago. I think the issue one is, I think there are a lot of issues. One of them is mistrust. People maybe just don't trust the vaccine yet, or sort of learning more as the vaccine, as time goes on. I think another issue is access. Now, there are some schools that have held sort of vaccine clinics. The district overall throughout the city has held a few hundred vaccine events since the fall. And Chicago has even had incentives. You can get a $100 Amazon gift card if you get vaccinated at a city site. But there are some communities where there's no place to get vaccinated within a mile of your home. And so it's a little bit of traveling. But in terms of kids, I mean, I think a lot of the issue is parents wanting to wait and see, and the messaging might not be there, even though the district's holding these vaccine events. We see another district like LA, for example, they're holding vaccine events, but they also mandated the vaccine, and that mandate doesn't kick in now until the fall. They delayed it, but their vaccination rates are much, much, much higher. The majority of students are vaccinated at this point. So I think part of the issue may be messaging, getting people that parents trust to explain to them the benefits of the vaccine. And at some point, maybe looking toward moving toward a mandate, just like more than a dozen other vaccines are mandated for Illinois students.
I'm wondering the extent to which what we are seeing in Chicago, and less here about the Omicron surge and more about the tensions between city leadership and the union, are you expecting to see these tensions flare up over the course of this, you know, what is undoubtedly going to be a tough winter in other cities? Or will the challenges that are occurring in Chicago maybe incentivize city leaders and union leaders to come to solutions before we get to this closing school for many days point?
So I think the moves that the Chicago Teachers Union makes and has made over the past few years have definitely spread to other cities. If you look at reopening negotiations last year, the CTU was one of the first teachers unions to raise a big fight, start a big fight with its district over the learning conditions, the teaching conditions, the classroom conditions that the district was offering. And you started to see other unions across the country start to implement some of the same arguments and sort of pointing out failures or holes in districts' plans. I think we're already starting to see some of the same worries spread to other districts. You saw a couple of days ago, a group of Oakland students started a petition calling on its district to implement more testing to provide KN95 masks, or else the students said they would go on strike. And you've seen a few other districts with teachers' unions raising some points. I don't think this exact acrimony will spread to other districts. What we've seen when the Chicago teachers' unions points spread across the country to other unions is there might be some fighting, but they're generally able to work out agreements. In Chicago, the relationship is just so bad between the union and the mayor's office, from Rahm Emanuel and now to Mayor Lori Lightfoot, that I don't think the trust is there. Their disagreements spread to other cities, but then those cities get deals and Chicago sort of drags on its situation. The other issue now is there's a mayoral election in about a year, and the mayor has viewed the Chicago Teachers Union as an opponent since day one, because they endorsed her opponent in the 2019 election. She's brought that up repeatedly, and she's expecting them to run a candidate against her about a year from now, with campaigning starting toward the end of this year. And so, no, this relationship isn't getting better. There's no chance. I don't think it gets better if it hasn't at this point.
Chicago, it is not a boring place to be an education reporter. Nader Issa is a reporter covering education for the Chicago Sun-Times. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
This is going to be one of the worst fires that we have witnessed during modern times here in the city of New York.
19 lives lost, 9 of them children. That is the tragic loss of human life that we know of so far from a fire that tore through a Bronx, New York City apartment on Sunday morning. 13 others are in critical condition. With us from WNYC and Gothamist is Jake Offenhartz. Jake, community first, what's the scene there and how are families coping in this chaos?
The people I spoke to yesterday were in shock. They all described just the speed at which their 19-story building filled up with black smoke yesterday. It started on the third floor, but there was a door open and it spread throughout the building. And people who tried to go into the hallways encountered basically pitch black, dark smoke. They described this black mucus feeling that they choked down from even seeing it for a second. And those that survived basically did so by staying inside their own apartments, waiting until the smoke went down enough that the fire department was able to make it in and evacuate them safely. Afterwards, there was a middle school that was turned into a Red Cross resource center, and there were families basically just trying to get their bearings, trying to locate loved ones, trying to figure out where they were going to sleep that night, what they were going to do about footwear, because they had to leave so quickly that they didn't bring shoes. And there was just this real sense of communal grief and mourning.
Now, this is not entirely unprecedented. In fact, although it is one of the deadliest fires in the city, the Bronx is actually a part of the city where we have seen several other major fires with multiple fatalities. Is there something particular about the Bronx?
It does seem like every major fire in New York City, or so many major fires, happen in the Bronx. I think one thing that's notable here is that this is the poorest congressional district in the country. And as Richie Torres, the Congress member, pointed out last night, poor housing stock results in more fires. And Black people in America, according to some data, are nearly twice as likely to die in residential fires So there's definitely an equity aspect here. What's interesting about this building is that it was designed as public housing in 1972. It was state funded, this sort of really experimental and ambitious project to build housing for low to middle income tenants that was affordable, but also high quality. There were some really prestigious architects who were involved, and it was seen as a success. There are also a lot of reports that it didn't really stay that way, that there was a lack of regular maintenance. The project, although it received state funding and money for state repairs, is owned by a group of private investors. And a lot of the tenants I spoke to said that there were just routine maintenance issues at the building, including the fact that this door, apparently inside the apartment where the space heater was on fire, the door was left open. Now, doors in New York City are required to close automatically for exactly this reason, so that if there's a fire, it doesn't spread. So Eric Adams said earlier today that he was going to look into, you know, this possible maintenance issue with the door.
I feel like you've provided us with that kind of big structural and historic equity issues, and also sort of an understanding about what may have been going on in the long term around the condition of the building. I want to narrow in just on the more short term, which is the impact of the COVID-19 Omicron surge. And it's my understanding that there were only 4 firefighters instead of 5 because so many people are sick out with COVID, and that Andrew Ansbrough of the FDNY Uniformed Firefighters Association actually suggested that that one additional firefighter might have made a difference.
Yeah, I think that's definitely something that we're going to be following here. I mean, the FDNY officials that we spoke to said that the response time was very quick. It was about 3 minutes, and that they had a lot of personnel there. There were 200 firefighters. But yeah, like just about any other city agency or workforce, the FDNY has been decimated by Omicron cases. And so if that did affect what they were able to do here, I think that'll be a pretty significant takeaway.
Jake Offenhartz, WNYC and Gothamist reporter, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
There are 4 questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
Thank you.
Time's gonna come, Joe. The time's gonna come. But if you want it to be right here, right now, that's okay with me.
Elegant, dignified, unforgettable, singular. These are just some of the words used to remember the groundbreaking actor Sidney Poitier, who made his final transition late Thursday night at 94 years old. Just 2 days later, the world lost another giant when Professor Lonnie Guinier passed away at the age of 71. Brilliant, prescient, formidable, strategic. This is just part of how Guinier's colleagues and students have remembered her. Poitier was the first Black man to win an Academy Award. Guinier, the first Black woman awarded tenure at Harvard Law School. But to describe either primarily as the first in their respective fields is so stunningly reductionist as to do violence to the legacy of each. Here is Poitier during a press conference in 1968.
You ask me questions that fall continually within the Negro-ness of my life. You ask me questions that pertain to the narrow scope of the summer riots. I am artist, man, American, contemporary. I am an awful lot of things, so I wish you would pay me the respect due and not simply ask me about those things.
Comments like these earned him harsh rebuke in the late 1960s by young activists whose movement for Black power centered racial pride in its organizing for cultural and political advancement. Some read Poitier's insistence on being understood as fully human as a kind of cowardly de-racialization. Scholar and voting rights advocate Lonnie Guinier also endured moments of painful critique and rejection, most publicly in 1993 when President Bill Clinton withdrew her nomination to serve as Assistant Attorney General after she was unfairly villainized as a so-called quota queen. Now, it's common in our current political moment to remember the early 90s as more civil and less divided. But the racist caricatures and uninformed attacks against Guinier are a reminder that far too often consensus really meant tacit agreement among elites to silence those who challenged the inequities of power. A common thread stitches together these two giants. Representation matters. From Potier, we experience a symbolic representation of self-possessed Black manhood. His career is emblematic of why the characters, images, and stories we witness on screen contribute to our sense of self and our place in the nation. In his life and in his craft, Potier resisted the infantilization and ignorance of white supremacy.
They call me Mr. Tibbs.
With Guinier, representation is a matter of politics rather than popular culture. Her work is an unflinching examination of our failure to adequately represent the diverse interests and identities in our country. She questioned the biases embedded in our political rules and unmasked the insidious ways racism warps democracy.
We can employ race as a lens to see things that are otherwise invisible. Race both masks and sustains deeply problematic, in my view, hierarchies of power and privilege.
And Guinier did more than diagnose problems. She offered creative, practical, democratic solutions like cumulative voting, ranked choice voting, and multi-member congressional districts. To live in a democracy is to have the right to govern, not simply to be governed, to speak, not simply to be spoken for, and to lose without fearing that winners take all. Representation matters, and here ends their great lesson. Sidney Poitier, Lonnie Guinier, yet more losses in this still young year. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. In 1983, President Ronald Reagan signed Public Law 98-144, designating the third Monday in January as an annual federal holiday to honor the life and work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The president's signature was the final step in a journey that began in 1968. Shortly after James Earl Ray assassinated Dr. King in Memphis, Tennessee, civil rights activists led by King's widow, Coretta Scott King, began fighting for official recognition of his work and contributions to the American Project. The journey to the holiday was fraught with racial and partisan tension, and nearly four decades after the holiday was established, we continue to have a complicated relationship with the memory and legacy of Dr. King. Far too often, lesson plans and public observances of King Day are limited to recitation of a few words from a single speech delivered in 1963.
I have a dream.
The King we recreate with our limited interpretation is solitary and frozen. His words are inspirational and symbolic. This King is safe. The living King did not stand alone. He was embedded in community. His vision for racial justice was not simple and fixed, it was complex and dynamic. His words and voice were important tools, but represented only one part of an evolving strategy. The living King was not safe. He was dangerous, a threat so formidable he was subjected to surveillance, violence, and ultimately assassination. With me now is Scott Roberts, Senior Director of Criminal Justice and Democracy Campaigns for Color of Change. Scott, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Here also is Patrice Cullors, New York Times bestselling author, educator, artist, and abolitionist. She's also the co-founder and former executive director of the Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation. Patrice, always great to talk with you.
Oh, so good to be here. Thank you so much.
All right, Patrice, I actually want to start with you. Help us to understand some of the ways that mainstream narratives about King misrepresent who he was and what he could potentially represent to next generations of activists.
Well, it's important for people to understand that King was challenging white supremacy. And so in that, he was challenging how the world viewed society. And so was often a target of misinformation. Disinformation was often a target often he was receiving death threats. He was receiving so much vitriol on a daily basis. I think if, you know, in the age of King, if there was social media, he would obviously be the target of bullying and bots and social media trolls.
You know, I so appreciate that, Scott. I want to come to you because I think there is this, of the many misrepresentations, one that I dislike and most galls me is this notion that King was safe. Malcolm X was dangerous. And so, King was celebrated. And I keep thinking, do you not know what actually happened with King around surveillance and violence and ultimately assassination? I'm wondering why in our remembering of King, we so frequently write out just how dangerous to the status quo he and the movement he was part of really were.
Yeah, I think it's because, for the last 50 plus years, Dr. King's legacy has been really contested, right? There's been a battle over what he stood for, what he did, how he helped to accomplish the things that he did. There's this there's a version of Dr. King presented in large part by the right of colorblindness, right? That one quote from his speech, that he wanted his children to live in a society where they're not judged by the color of their skin, but the content of their character is turned into a whole, the sum of his beliefs and ideology versus, the real Dr. King, which was, a man pushing for voting rights. And also there's this portrait of him tactically, I think, that's really important, the idea that Dr. King, the focus on nonviolence, as opposed to looking at how confrontational the actions and tactics that he employed were. I think, Ava DuVernay, who obviously is one of the real leaders in terms of portraying Black folks, but also leading on racial justice issues in Hollywood, did a good service with the movie Selma, right, to show how confrontational and radical it was to do that, and the resistance that he got even within his own movement there. So I think, there's been this struggle over his legacy. And even, one of the things that used to annoy me the most on Martin Luther King Day during the Obama administration was the email that you would get telling you to go and do a community service action. So I think even within, the Democratic coalition, there's a contest over whether Dr. King's legacy is one pushing for radical and transformative change versus, doing right by your neighbor, which obviously is a part of what he had to say, but I think it's frustrating when it's reduced to that. Right.
Yeah, Patrice, on that kind of reductionism, even this notion that we should, kind of keep looking back and say, what would Martin Luther King do? What would Martin Luther King say? How, as an inheritor of the work for justice, do you think about King within the context of your own work?
I really see King as not just someone who was working on domestic issues, but honestly a leader that was looking at the international politics of his time. He was really challenging the war. He was challenging imperialism. He was challenging capitalism. And that is often so left out of his legacy, but so critical for us to understand what we have inherited as movement leaders, as people who are challenging capitalism and challenging the role the U.S. government has played, not just here in the country, in the U.S., but also around the world.
So, Scott, let me come to you because you were talking about strategy before the break. And I want to think around the strategy piece because there are ways that we can look to Dr. King's strategy, his understanding of himself, his use of media. But there were also real challenges with his strategy and maybe specifically the lack of intersectionality. Maybe you could speak a bit around how today's movements, how the work that you're doing at Color of Change is seeking to in part be a corrective around gender and queer identity and other intersections of racial struggle.
One, just the centering of Dr. King within our movements. As important and critical as he was to the advancement of racial justice is in itself, you know, just focuses attention once again on, you know, a cisgender straight man, but also, you know, the politics of the time. You know, there you just think about the posters of the marches where folks were carrying signs, "I am a man," just erasing the you know, women and non-gender conforming folks in the Black community. You see if you read up on the stories of Dr. King's relationship with Bayard Rustin and the way that Bayard Rustin was a brilliant strategist really behind a lot of the best work that Dr. King did as a gay man, was, you know, forced to do his work in the shadows and eventually kind of pushed away from the inner circle of Dr. King. I think today's movement, and I would credit people like Patrice, you know, far more than myself and Color of Change for this, but and organizations like the Black Youth Project and Black Lives Matter, so many other groups around the country, young people who have really pushed back against those oversimplifications. I think there's a need. We're seeing more and more leadership today, I think, from women, from queer folks in our movement. And that's critical. And I think, you know, we also have to, I think even myself, I can speak from my perspective as a straight cisgender man who has been in this work, you know, trying to take a backseat in a lot of situations, right? And push for leadership and create the spaces and the room for folks to speak. So with that, I think I'd love to hear Patrice's thoughts on this myself.
Absolutely. That's exactly where I was going to come to hear Patrice's is to reflect a bit on sort of how Dr. King's sometimes problematic legacy around issues of gender and queer identity, as well as others, class was part of all of that, influenced sort of that, sort of building on King, but also diverting from him.
You know, the biggest moment for us, especially as folks who have taken on his legacy, is to both understand it as something that we are inheriting, but also understanding as something that we are challenging. You know, many of us movement leaders who are Black women, queer, understood that while King challenged white supremacy, he didn't challenge patriarchy. And that's not something to look back at and completely judge him on, but it is to look back at and say, hey, this is something we want to do different. And this generation, I do also want to say that, you know, King was someone who was really evolving in his understanding and of his role and the role of the US and the role of the police and the military. And so much of what gets lost in his legacy and his current legacy is this conversation about how he challenged the military, how he challenged the police. And I think that's so important because so much of this generation is pushing back and challenging policing and the military and imprisonment as we know it.
It seems hard, Patrice, for me to imagine that someone misses that King is challenging policing. In fact, again, if we're thinking about some of those misrepresentations, it's sometimes that notion of, as Scott was saying earlier, of a nonviolent social movement, rather than reflecting that the movement was quite violent. It was provocative of violence, provocative of police violence as a way of demonstrating, of laying bare what the state had done as a matter of violence over and against Black bodies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a quote that I wanted to read to y'all, which is, you know, King said, quote, "A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death," end quote. That feels critical to me because, you know, if we think about this movement to defund the police, to abolish the police, I wholeheartedly believe that King would be a part of that movement. He would be saying, hey, you guys, we are spending way too much money on the military, way too much money on the police, and there are no social, there's no social welfare institution in this country anymore. We see that right now in the middle of COVID, right? While we're watching this pandemic rage on and having this medical industrial complex that is so unable to really fit the bill in this moment. I think King would be challenging all these things right now.
You know, I wonder, Scott, so to Patrice's point about, you know, where King would be, what he would be challenging. And it seems to me that undoubtedly would have to do with what relationships, what community he found himself in, that he was always responding to and part of a broader conversation. And yet when we represent him, when we think about him on King Day, he does end up almost like that, you know, like the monument of him in D.C., like it's just him carving out of mountain as though he's not from community.
Yeah, I was hoping to get a chance to talk about this. I think one of the challenges of, you know, the way in which Dr. King's legacy has been contested and the way he's just, you know, he's been portrayed has, as I think I said earlier, taken up a kind of outsized portion of the history of the movement. And so a lot of times we miss not only the folks who were behind the scenes working with King, like Bayard Rustin, who, you know, I mentioned earlier, but also the broad range of organizations and tactics that were being implemented, right? Even, you know, I mentioned Selma earlier, even in the arguments there, right? You didn't actually see, for instance, in John Lewis's story arc where, you know, he had the tensions with SNCC. You didn't actually see the work and the tactics that SNCC had been doing just the summer before in Mississippi, in the Mississippi Summer Project, which, you know, a lot of folks now will refer to as Freedom Summer, which was not a bunch of marches and, you know, nonviolent actions. It was people on the ground organizing door to door, registering people to vote, which engendered the same types of violence. And also captured the nation's attention and shifted a lot of hearts and minds on the issue of voting rights. And so I think, you know, I would encourage people this, you know, MLK Day to try to dig in and think about, learn more about the broad range of tactics, because I think it would help people put today's movement more in perspective, right? And help us move beyond this notion of, you know, who's right, who's wrong, which is the right thing to do and not. And understand we're in a movement where there's going to be a diversity of approaches, and we have to have that in order to advance things.
Scott Roberts, Senior Director of Criminal Justice Campaigns for Color of Change, and Patrice Cullors, New York Times bestselling author, educator, artist, and abolitionist. Thank you both for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Well, that was a heavy Monday. Thanks for sticking with us through it. And listen, we need you as much as you need us during these times, maybe more. So tell us what we should be looking at, what we should be talking about, how we should be maybe thinking about these big questions facing us. 877-869-8253. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE. Use that number. Call us. Thanks so much for spending time with us. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.